I had forgotten that your parents came all the way from Thailand to serve George Washington.
Say what, Senator?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. Mm-hmm. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM, people-powered radio in L.A., up in Oregon on 91.7 FM, KYAQ on the Central Coast, and 106.7 FM, Queso in Cottage Grove, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 93 FM, WLRI News Radio, in Hawaii on 88.5 FM, KAKU, the voice of Maui, in Columbus, Ohio, on WGRN 94.1 FM, the Green Renaissance Network, and in Palinville, New York, on 102.9 FM WLPP, not to mention AM 950 in Minneapolis, St. Paul, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We're also heard streaming coast to coast and around the globe on the intertubes on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, Radio Sputnik, and other unnamed but fantastic affiliates blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Not that planet Earth needs a blanket at this point. Hello, Desi Doyen. How
hello.
Are you?
Good one.
Thank you. I just wrote it. anyway, a lot of coming up. One of the most unreported stories of the election season, and frankly, that's saying quite a bit. There are so many underreported stories this election season. Remember that whole discussion about dark, undisclosed money in politics in the wake of Citizens United? You know, that conversation that it seems like we stopped having entirely pretty much from the moment that Donald Trump descended down that escalator back on June 16, 2015? Yeah, well, that's still a problem. Whether we're talking about it or not, and in places where you might not even think about it being a problem very often. That's coming up momentarily, but we do have, in the past 24 hours, a remarkable amount of breaking news. So we are exercising our option to pick and choose what we're going to cover, I guess, today, what we have time to cover, frankly. And of course, this is our way of, suppressing, censoring all the news we don't want to talk about, that we don't want you to hear about, because, you know, that's what we do here in the media, right?
Well, sure.
and in any event, let's start here. From and I've rewritten the lead to this show, I don't know how many times today, with so many things breaking. Anyway, from underreported to overreported, let's go to the news that seems to have sucked the life out of cable news today as of this afternoon when the story broke. Word that the FBI is not even reopening. I'm not sure what the right word is. Continuing, taking additional steps in its FBI email probe of Hillary Clinton's private email server. So they're sort of reopening the investigation, sort of, but not really. And given the amount of attention that this story has gotten today on the cable news.
Oh, it's a cablegasm. A total cablegasm.
Well said. It is. Like, this is it. This is the October surprise.
It's the most important thing in the world.
Yeah, maybe. But not yet. As soon as I heard it, I wasn't even sure. I was like, okay, why is that even worth covering at all today, frankly? It'll be worth covering something if something is revealed. But if you look at the actual letter, so James Comey sends this letter to the Select Committee on U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And it's basically this, three paragraphs. And here's the actual letter. Here's what he actually told the Senate investigators. He said, due to recent developments, I'm writing to supplement my previous testimony. In connection with an unrelated case, the FBI has learned of the existence of emails that appear to be pertinent to this investigation. I am writing to inform you that the investigative team briefed me on this yesterday, and I agreed that the FBI should take appropriate investigative steps designed to allow investigators to review these emails to determine whether they contain classified information, as well as to assess their importance to our investigation. Although the FBI cannot yet assess whether or not this material may be significant, and I cannot predict how long it will take to complete the additional work, I believe it's important to update your committees about our efforts in light of my previous testimony. So he's basically letting them know, hey, we found some additional emails in another case, and so we're going to look at them to make sure that there's no classified information there, like there wasn't in the tens of thousands of emails that they had already looked at that the FBI director James Comey had reported to the U.S. Senate about. Now, he has not given an update. He gives an update on these cases, but as our friend David Dayan noticed and asked, when is James Comey going to update us about what happened to all the criminal referrals of bankers to the FBI? Comey doesn't seem to keep us quite as up to date on those investigations as he does on this one, but okay. I'm not even sure what to make of this. Like I said, I was like, okay, so what? Let me know when there is something of note to report in this case. But the fact that they're just looking at these emails, maybe there'll be something explosive there. Now, these emails are reportedly related to some investigation into Anthony Weiner's sexting issues. And if there's something explosive, fantastic. We will report it. Right now, it's like, okay, well, we'll look at these things and see if there's anything there. I don't know if I'm missing anything or not. Am I missing anything as you see it, Desi?
I'm not sure. I can tell you that Sam Stein, who was following this very closely, Sam Stein of the Huffington Post, he said, okay, so this is not about Clinton sent emails. These are not emails that Hillary Clinton sent. It's not about her server. They didn't come for her or through her server. That they were found on an Anthony Weiner device. There may be only a few emails. And he said that, the FBI statement is almost, quote, almost irresponsible in its brevity.
Well, what is more irresponsible, frankly, is the way this has been regarded by the news media. Until there is a story, why are you freaking everyone out with breaking news headlines and banners and, going wall to wall on this? I don't get it.
Very weird.
It wouldn't be the first time I didn't understand the corporate mainstream media. So there's that. And if anything does develop there, of course, we will report it. One thing I do want to report, just because there's some amazing audio here, and I want to make sure we get to this. Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois, he's in a tough reelection battle against Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth in Illinois. And she is, if you don't know who Tammy Duckworth is, she was born in Bangkok, Thailand. She's an Iraq War veteran. She's a Purple Heart recipient. She grew up in Southeast Asia before her family moved to Hawaii. In 2004, she lost both of her legs and partial use of one of her arms after the combat helicopter that she was flying in Iraq was hit by an RPG. She's a congresswoman. She's trying to unseat Mark Kirk, who is the Republican incumbent, and he's in big trouble in Illinois. I would say after what happened last night at this debate between the two of them that he is done. He is cooked. He is through. During the debate, Duckworth was talking about her military service, which I don't think anyone questions, as well as the long history of military service in her own family. She said, as she has many times on the campaign trail, that her family has served this nation in uniform going back to the revolution. Now, here is her comment and Mark Kirk's response to that comment. And we're going to leave in all the pauses here just so you can see how well his response went over in the room.
My family has served this nation in uniform, going back to the revolution. I'm a daughter of the American Revolution. I've bled for this nation. But I still want to be there in the Senate when the drums of war sound, because people are quick to sound the drums of war, and I want to be there to say, this is what it costs. This is what you're asking us to do. And if that's the case, I'll go. Families like mine are the ones that bleed first. But let's make sure the American people understand what we are engaging in, and let's hold our allies accountable, because we can't do it all.
Thank Senator you. Kirk, 30 seconds to rebut.
I had forgotten that your parents came all the way from Thailand to serve George Washington.
Move on to the next question. This is Bernie Schoenberg. Now,
all right, hold on for a second. So Duckworth says her family served all the way back to the Revolution, and he says, I forgot your parents came all the way from Thailand to serve George Washington. That went over well in the room like a lead balloon. It kind of sounded like this in truth.
I had forgotten that your parents came all the way from Thailand to serve George Washington.
That was the sound of the lead balloon exploding in that room. Boy, did he bomb on that one. Her father, Tammy Duckworth's father, her father's side of the family, has a long history of serving the U.S. going all the way back to the Revolutionary War. But I guess because she was born in Thailand, she's not welcome to that privilege as Senator. U.S. Senator Mark Kirk sees it. Here's what happened after his response.
Move on to the next question. This is Bernie Schoenberg. Now your chance. We'll start with Congresswoman Duckworth first to respond.
And you're welcome to take some time if you want to respond to that, too.
Sure. There's been members of my family serving in uniform on my father's side going back to the Revolution. I belong to the William J. Penny chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution right here. And if you go to Mount Vernon, Illinois, you'll see a statue of me put up by the Daughters of the American Revolution next to one of our great, great patriots, Molly Pitcher, one of the first women to pick up her husband's position during the Revolution. I'm proud of both my father's side and my mother, who's an immigrant. She became an American citizen in her 50s, and
let me get in one last question.
So, Mark Kirk is done.
He should be.
He should be toast after that comment. Now, mind you, Mark Kirk had unendorsed Donald Trump, calling him, quote, too bigoted and too racist to be president.
Oh, man.
So, hey, Mark, the call is coming from inside your own house. And it reminded me of, remember Scott Brown, Senator Scott Brown in his contest against Senator Elizabeth Warren?
Up in Massachusetts? Oh,
yeah,
yes,
when
I
he
do.
Snarked on her. You remember it, I know specifically, when he snarked on her Cherokee background. Because I guess because she's blonde and she's not very Indian-y looking.
Right.
As Scott Brown saw it. Now, Desi Doyen, I always got to point back to you on this because you're kind of blonde and not very Indian-y looking.
Nope.
And yet your great, what is it, great, great?
My fifth great grandfather was a big Cherokee.
A big Cherokee.
Yeah, a big Cherokee.
Yes, he was a big Cherokee.
He's very instrumental in history, and it's a long story. But yes, and so it is possible to have, you know, provable ancestry, and hers is difficult to prove because there are not a whole lot of written records, but there are some potential, you know, but that doesn't matter because essentially they're saying, Trump likes to call her Pocahontas, for example.
Trump calls Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas.
Which is, you know,
right. The
wrong tribe to start with, but also extremely racially offensive.
And going back to Duckworth here, she's a daughter of the American Revolution. They don't let people into that organization, right? Unless they check
can
their,
prove it.
Yeah, unless
you
they
have to
prove,
have the documents,
right? Because your family, you're kind of from daughters of the.
We're also
Texas,
daughters of the American Revolution, right? And also daughters of the Texas Republic.
So you know how that paperwork goes. They
it's
check that stuff out, right?
Oh, yeah.
So unbelievable. I forgot your parents came all the way from Thailand to serve George Washington.
Deeply offensive.
Unbelievable. He has since apologized, Mark Kirk has, but it took until today. He put this on Twitter this morning. Sincere apologies to an American hero, Tammy Duckworth, and gratitude for her family's service. He might as well have added, congratulations on your election to the U.S. Senate. Okay, just wanted to make sure to get that in because that was just shocking to me. Some interesting news about the money in the presidential race in these last remaining days, as we are just a little bit more than a week away from Election Day. As NBC News reports, not only is the GOP lagging when it comes to early voting operations, but Donald Trump has now a serious cash problem, they say. The Republican presidential candidate has just $16 million on hand and is $2 million in debt. That, according to filings with the Federal Elections Commission through mid-October. The outlook, which will be the last FEC filing before Election Day, looks a bit better for Trump when the totality of his two other fundraising committees are included. That gives him $67 million for the final days. And I love how NBC News say that he's serious cash problems. The dude has $67 million to spend in the next week. But that apparently is a problem, at least compared to the Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton, who's in a much better position. Her campaign and two fundraising committees have more than twice what Donald Trump has. She has $153 million in the bank, and she has just $111,000 in debt. So compare that to Donald Trump, $2 million in debt. After his campaign has been, you know, complaining about the government is in debt, we can't continue running up these debts. Well, he's run up $2 million in debt. Clinton has only run up $111,000. And more of note here, it turns out he's a liar. You may have heard, I don't know, Donald Trump is a liar. He had pledged as recently as this week to donate $100 million to his effort. He gave just $30,000 this month, in the last month before the election. $30,000. He's pledged $100 million. He's given about $56 million. That's a lot of money, I guess, to his campaign. Most of that was during the primary election when he was self-funding, but he's only got a few days left to give $44 million. If he follows through on his pledge to give $100 million to his campaign. Now, mind you, they say that's $56 million, which is what he's given so far, is a lot of money. I guess it is, but he claims to be a billionaire. He claims to be worth $10 billion. And I did some math here. If a guy who is worth $10 billion gives $56 million, it was hard doing this math. I'm not good at math, and my calculator actually doesn't go up to $10 billion. Put it in this. If I got this right, I think I did. Let's say I have a net worth. I'm a normal person-ish, and I've got a net worth of $100,000 to run for school board or something, right? But my net worth is $100,000. I'm going to run for a small, you know, election somewhere for dog catcher. That would be the equivalent of me putting in $560. To my campaign. That's all. That's how much Donald Trump has put into his campaign, if he's telling the truth about being worth $10 billion. I'll leave it to you if you want to believe that. But he put in a mere $31,000 in the first 19 days of October, which is, you know, kind of amazing. And also underscores that, as I said, he may be a liar. And by the way, so he's put since the GOP primary, he's put in $2 million each month into the campaign. That would be the equivalent of that guy who's worth $100,000 putting in $20 a month to his own campaign. That's how much he's forking out. And a lot of it is coming back in because he's charging rent to the campaign. So a lot of money has gone to rent at Trump Tower and catering from his own restaurants. And he's even billing the campaign for Trump ice bottled water that's been showing up at his events. Nonetheless, with the obscene amount of money, and it is an obscene amount of money, particularly dark money that has come in from undisclosed sources in U.S. elections this year that we're not talking about at all, particularly following the 2010 Citizens United ruling at the Supreme Court, all of that dark money coming in has been somewhat obscured by the emergence of this supposed billionaire. And this wildly dishonest, unqualified one at that, running for president. But concerns about dark, undisclosed money in American elections have not gone away, not only at the presidential level, but also at the congressional, the senatorial, and even the state and local level. That continues, or at least it should. It has not received the type of attention it deserves, particularly from the corporate media, which I need to remind you is the beneficiary of a great majority of all of this campaign spending that you hear about. That all goes to the media for ads. So no wonder they don't want to talk about it. Why bite the hand that feeds them so well? Yet that dark money and the conflicts of interest that it leads to, that remains a concern to elections at the federal level, the state level, and the local legislative offices as well. But it's also a concern at the judicial level, and perhaps even more so there, for reasons that I will discuss with my guest in the next segment. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As President Obama took the extraordinary step of endorsing a candidate for a state Supreme Court race this week, spending by outside groups on television ads in all such contests hit a record high nationwide, according to a new analysis by the Brennan Center for Justice. These developments, they write, underscore the growing importance of state courts in national politics and the expanding influence of secret money in targeting judges unfavorable to corporate agendas and other special interests. The millions of dollars spent, much of it without meaningful disclosure or accountability, raise serious questions of conflicts of interest and pose a troubling threat to core values of fairness and judicial integrity. And this is something we've been talking about on this show on and off for the past year or so. I'm troubled by these judicial elections, and this is just one of the reasons why. Brennan Center goes on to say that outside groups have already spent a record $14 million on television ads in the 2015 and 2016 state Supreme Court election cycle, including nearly $4 million this fall. That, according to an analysis of television ad contracts posted on the FCC website, state disclosures and data for Kantar Media. The prior record for outside group spending on judicial races was $13.5 million back in 2011 and 2012, according to Brennan Center. State political parties, in contrast, have been relatively minor players this fall, with approximately $188,000 worth of television ad buys in Michigan and Washington, all from the state Republican Party in that case. Recent experience suggests outside spending will continue to surge in the final weeks before Election Day. So what you've got here is these outside groups who are unaccountable, dark money in many of these cases, outspending even the political parties, not to mention the judges who are up for elections. When outside groups pour money into judicial races, it puts our whole system at risk, says Alicia Bannon, senior counsel in the Brennan Center's democracy program. She says our democracy relies on judges to decide cases based on their understanding of the law and the facts in front of them and not out of fears about their next election. Yeah, that's a good point. Joining us now is Alicia Bannon. She serves as senior counsel on the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, where she leads the center's Fair Courts work. She has authored several nationally recognized reports and articles on judicial selection and access to justice, and she has clerked for Sonia Sotomayor back when she was on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Alicia Bannon, welcome to the Bradcast.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here, and I really appreciate your report, because this is something that has bothered the hell out of me for years, this idea that these judges, these state Supreme Court justices, that they are even up for election at all. So let me start broadly here, because I am troubled by this. The election of judges, period. Much less state Supreme Court justices. How many states generally select judges this way, put them up for a vote, making them open to the kind of political attacks that your analysis cites?
38 states use some kind of election to choose their Supreme Court justices. So mm-hmm. that includes both contested elections where you have multiple candidates vying for a single seat, and then it also includes what are called retention elections, mm-hmm. where a sitting judge, goes up on the ballot and the public basically votes yes or no whether or not to keep them on the bench. So, you know, all in, most states, the vast majority of states, use elections as part of their selection system. And, you know, around the country, we've been seeing these elections become higher cost, more politicized, and attracting a lot of special interest attention.
Well, that's what I want to, setting aside, even for the moment, if we set aside the dark money, the fact that we don't know where the money is coming from in many of these cases by, you know, from outside groups, what is the problem, as you see it, if any, with judges being held accountable to the people in elections versus the type of appointment system that we see in some states and at the U.S. Supreme Court level, for example?
Well, I think it goes to what a judge's job is. You know, in the end, a judge needs to be deciding cases based on their understanding of what the law requires and the facts that are in front of them, and not out of fears of what that's going to mean for, you know, fundraising in the next election cycle or what's going to be the subject of their next attack ad. And I think what's troubling about as these elections are becoming more politicized is the kind of pressure that it puts on judges in deciding cases and in doing their jobs. I think there's a real worry that if judges are too mixed up in the rough and tumble of politics, that's going to make it harder for them to step out of that and decide the cases that are in front of them under, you know, according to their understanding of the law.
The alternative to these elections then is, I guess, a system of appointments. Is that better than a system of democratic elections after all these appointments are made by, you know, partisan governors who are, face that same system of money in politics? I mean, what is the better system that you'd like to see?
Well, you know, there's no system is perfect, and there's advantages and disadvantages to all systems. I'd say that there are some problems that actually states face across the board. So there's only three states, for example, that have life tenure for judges. So in every other state, in appointment systems and election systems, judges have to keep going before these political bodies, either a governor or the public at large, for reappointment or reelection. And I think those concerns about job security can be are really troubling in terms of having a court that's independent and kind of deciding decisions based on the law. So I think I would say I don't think that it falls strictly on kind of election versus appointment grounds. I think there's other considerations as well, such as, you know, how are you structuring your system, and to what extent are you insulating judges from these reselection pressures in particular. But, you know, I'd say elections right now, at least as they are functioning today, aren't working. You know, it's interesting because elections were actually a reform measure. You know, going back to the 19th century, all judges were appointed either by the governor or by legislatures, and there was real concern that those judges were too closely aligned with the political branches, that they weren't being an adequate check on governors and legislatures, that they were letting them run wild. Mm-hmm. And so elections were an effort to basically further empower courts so that they would do a better job of protecting people's rights and pushing back against overreach by the political branches. But I think what we're seeing now, as these elections are becoming so high cost and captured by special interests, is that they're not serving that function anymore. And if anything, they're putting even more pressure on judges because of the money involved and the conflicts of interest that get created.
Indeed, your analysis finds, I'll read a piece of this here, the Republican State Leadership Committee, which sounds like, it's a party, it's the party. In fact, it's a corporate-funded group. Their mission is to elect Republicans in down-ballot races. They're the largest outside spender in Supreme Court races this cycle. They've spent more than $620,000 on TV this fall in Ohio alone, and $225,000 to a group called StopSetEmFreeSendifer.com up in Montana, donated $43,000 in kind for polling and research. And so far to date, the Republican State Leadership Committee, this corporate-funded group, has spent nearly $4.1 million on just six Supreme Court races in the 2015-2016 cycle in six states: Pennsylvania, Arkansas, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Montana. That's a lot of money, and that's just from one group. You list some others as well who are targeting, for example, North Carolina, Families First, a progressive-leaning political action committee, has been paying, they purchased ad contracts worth $670,000 in the North Carolina Supreme Court race this year. Do we have any measure of, you know, which parties are doing this more than the other? Is it Republicans doing it more, Democrat leaning groups, or are they about even at this point?
Yep. And one thing to say is just, you know, some of those numbers, it might, you know, in a presidential election year where people talk about, you know, billions of dollars going in, you know, it might not sound like much, but for a judicial election, it's a huge amount of money, especially because these are really low information races. Mm-hmm. So usually people don't know anything about these candidates. And so, you know, having the ability to buy television ads and give name recognition to a candidate can have a huge impact on who ends up winning one of these races. So, you know, this money is, you know, in the presidential election season, it might not sound like much, but it has a huge impact to sway these elections and these courts. And in terms of who's been paying attention, you know, overwhelmingly in recent years, it's been kind of conservative and business interests that have been outspending the other side. And that's especially the case with respect to national groups like the Republican State Leadership Committee, which has been targeting a bunch of states around the country. Now, it's interesting because this year, there's some sense that may be starting to change. So this North Carolina race has attracted, substantial spending on both sides, but including spending from groups with links to national organizations on the left, as well as the endorsement by President Obama. So, you know, maybe a signal that folks on the left are starting to pay more attention to these races, and, you know, we might start seeing more parity, at least in some states, as there are these battles over which direction, which partisan direction a court may be going.
And even if, you're right, that's a lot of money. When you get the words set 'em free, Sandifer, or whatever that website was called, if you can paint a judge that way, people don't necessarily look much further. They remember those slogans. They don't need a lot of ads comparatively to make a choice. I know that when I go, to vote, oftentimes I know nothing about the judges. I don't vote in those races at all because I don't want to vote the wrong way. But setting aside whether one believes they should face pressure from Democratic elections, I suspect a lot of people think that's a good thing. That is a lot of money. Do we, the public, have any idea where it comes from? A lot of these cases, and I guess more to the point, do the judges themselves, the justices or the judges who are being supported or even being opposed here, because that would pose a conflict of interest as well. They'd like to get back at those people who had opposed them. Do those justices know where any of this money actually comes from?
So increasingly, secret money is becoming a big part of these judicial races. So, of the outside spending that we've been documenting thus far, I think only three of 13 or 14 groups that have been spending so far have full disclosure of their donors. All the others are either themselves secret money groups that don't disclose their donors, or if you go one level down and see who their donors are, they're just a bunch of other PACs and social welfare groups. So it's like unpeeling an onion trying to figure out where is this money actually coming from. Secret money is always concerning because it leaves the voters in the dark about who's trying to influence these elections and shape these courts. But you're exactly right that in the judicial context, there's also this second set of concerns about conflicts of interest, and that there are conflicts that may be obscured because of the use of these dark money conduits. Do the judges know? You know, we don't always know. I mean, I think that, there may be cases where judges are, appearing at events and, talking to people that are, committing to be spending one way or the other. So, in some circumstances, they may be aware of, you know, who's behind some of the spending. In others, they might not be. I think one of the concerns, though, is that it kind of casts a shadow on all of these proceedings and raises these questions about, you know, are litigants and others involved in these cases, you know, actually being active participants in these elections. And, mm-hmm. you know, in the judicial context, appearances really matter. You know, it's not just, if you look at kind of what the Constitution requires and what all the state ethics rules require for judges, you know, it's you know, obviously judges need to step aside from cases when they're actually biased, but also when there's reasonable concerns of bias mm-hmm. as well. And so, you know, when you see all of this money and it's all shrouded in secret, I think it does raise legitimate questions on the part of the public about who's behind it, what are their interests, and are, you know, what do judges know or not know about it, and, you know, what is it doing to my chance of getting a fair hearing mm-hmm. if I'm in court?
Which is why you always hear the phrase, the appearance of conflict of interest. It's not necessarily the conflict of interest itself, it's just the appearance of it and the concern that people will have. You know, can a judge rule fairly, you know, if the only reason they are sitting there is because they have been funded by X, Y, and Z? I got a specific sort of question on that in a second. But we've been talking on this program about the Republican Red Map project, the redistricting project to redraw congressional districts back in 2010 by putting a relatively small amount of money into very specific down ballot races in state legislatures to take them over and thereby back in 2010, the census year, be able to redraw the congressional maps. Is there any signs that this effort is akin to that sort of GOP operative sort of working at the hyper local level to maximize the party's political leverage across the court systems as well? I mean, I think we saw evidence of that pretty clearly to some extent in the Wisconsin Supreme Court fight, very contentious back in 2011, in the battle for a friendly majority for Governor Scott mm-hmm. Walker's pretty radical anti-union agenda back there in the state. They were clearly using that for political purposes. Is there any evidence that this effort is sort of a larger effort by the Republican Party or by the Democratic Party?
Well, and in Wisconsin, there were these remarkable statements in these documents that were recently leaked to The Guardian, where you had, you know, Scott Walker's operatives basically saying, you know, we need to keep the court because mm-hmm. the court's what's going to protect us. You know, so I think they were very much viewing the Wisconsin Supreme Court in those terms. You know, state Supreme Courts are really important, and they hear cases that have, you know, high stakes, among other things. They hear redistricting challenges. And, you know, that's actually an issue that's become quite salient this year in North Carolina, mm-hmm. where, you know, that's a state where right now it's a court that's controlled by a slim Republican majority, and that swing vote is up for election this year. And, you know, previously the North Carolina Supreme Court upheld a redistricting scheme that mm-hmm. was challenged as an illegal racial gerrymander. Subsequently, a federal court found that it was a racial gerrymander, and it's going up to the U.S. Supreme Court right now. You know, and that redistricting decision itself has become a campaign issue. So the judge who's up for election wrote the decision upholding that scheme and, mm-hmm. you know, is being characterized now as basically having, you know, upheld a racist scheme to support his party. That's, you know, that there are ads that are going up right now mm-hmm. that are characterizing his decision in that way. And, you know, I certainly think that one of the reasons why that race is getting so much attention, and in general why races that are involved kind of closely divided courts tend to attract a lot of attention from parties and special interests, is because they're so powerful and because they can decide cases like those involving redistricting that can have a huge impact on the policy and legal environment in the state.
And this was the case where you mentioned that Barack Obama had come out and actually endorsed Superior Court Judge Michael Morgan in that race in North Carolina. How unusual is that for a sitting president to come out and make an endorsement like that? And does it suggest that, you know, even though in that case it's not a big dark money ad buy, but that these court races are being recognized like pretty much every election in the nation at this point as, you know, becoming far more politicized than has been the tradition in this country for many years?
Yeah, you know, the president's endorsement was pretty remarkable. I mean, I certainly don't know of another example where a United States president has weighed in on a state judicial race. And I think you're exactly right that it shows just how politically charged many of these races are becoming and what the stakes are, you know, and I think the concern is that this can lead to essentially an arms race where you're just going to see a lot of money pouring in on all sides, you know, a lot more attention, you know, they become a lot more politically charged. And the problem is that then you still have judges needing to decide these cases, you know, and what do you do when you're hearing a case that's, you know, on a hot button issue? And, you know that it's going to be grist for, you know, if you rule one way, you know it's going to be grist mm-hmm. for an attack ad, or you know that it's going to bring, you know, a few billionaires in your state to pour some money in to challenge you the next time that you're up for election. You know, that puts pressure on judges in a way that I think can be really harmful to the integrity of our system. And, you know, the thing with courts is, you know, courts don't have armies, right? Courts don't have police officers. They don't have a way to enforce their decisions except the legitimacy that they have in the public's eye. And so if courts start being seen as just another political actor, no different than any other elected official, then they start to lose that legitimacy, and that really undermines the core of what they are. Mm. So I do think it's a really troubling development, you know, and not that you can never criticize a court decision or never express an opinion on a Supreme Court race, but I think the broader structural questions of, you know, how judicial selection is operating now and how elections are operating now, is that really consistent with, you know, how we want our judicial system to operate is a really important question, and I think one that states have not been sufficiently engaging with as they're looking at how their systems are working.
I remember when the Iowa, I think it was Iowa Supreme Court, some years ago, the justices had essentially agreed that a ban on marriage equality in the state was unconstitutional mm-hmm. under the state constitution. They were then targeted by right-wing groups very specifically for removal. I think that it was successful. I think they got him off the court.
Three justices lost their seats.
And I don't think it was a matter of them disagreeing with the decision on a legal basis. They just didn't like the decision. I think that they were right as far as constitutionally goes, but they just didn't like it. So that said, just to, I guess, be the devil's advocate here, what's to say that's not the right kind of use for judicial elections? In other words, hold justices accountable to the people. Why not?
Well, I think it goes to what you mean by accountable. You know, there's different ways that you can hold judges accountable. You know, if they're making legal mistakes, mm-hmm. that's why we have appeals. And, you know, things can go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court if a state high court makes a mistake on a legal matter. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have judges that are acting unethically or don't have, you know, the appropriate temperament, you know, they're not acting as they should, there's disciplinary processes that, you know, are in place or should be in place to address those kinds of concerns. So I think the question is whether or not we want to put, you know, whether we think it's important to have, you know, the public just weighing in on their kind of opinions on the wisdom of particular, you know, judicial decisions. And, you know, I think there is a concern there because, you know, judges are not supposed to just go with what the majority prefers. You know, there's a long history going back to, you know, pushing back against segregation and marriage equality. I mean, there's a whole set of issues where what's popular might not be what's constitutional. And, you know, judges sometimes have to push back against what the majority prefers because our constitutions protect individual rights, even against majority preferences. And so I do think there's a real tension if what you mean by accountability is you know, sort of empowering majority will mm-hmm. when, you know, a judge's job is not just to go with what the majority wants.
It's to go with what the law is, the state constitution is, whether it's a good law or a good constitution, I guess. We've got just a minute or two left here with Alicia Bannon of the Brennan Center for Justice. Alicia, we had mentioned Wisconsin and this David Prosser. I want to ask something specific about that. That in that Wisconsin Supreme Court election, for Prosser, tied to Scott Walker at the time. I believe Prosser has since retired. But in that case, outside groups had far outspent the money that the candidate himself, Prosser, and Kloppenburg, who he was running against, Joanne Kloppenburg, that they were able, the outside groups had outspent the campaigns themselves. And then this state investigation into collusion between Governor Scott Walker and the groups that had funded both his recall election in 2012 and the Prosser Supreme Court election a few months earlier, that came before that investigation came before the Supreme Court itself. But Prosser and another one of the justices whose name is escaping me at the moment, but was also funded by those same groups, mm-hmm. they refused to recuse themselves from the ruling that ended up killing that investigation into the groups that they themselves had been funded by. Is that an unusual case, or is that exactly the type of problem that we're seeing with this outside funding of judicial elections?
Right, and talk about appearances, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't look very good.
No.
You know, it's a huge issue. And I mean, one of the problems that the states that use judicial elections have is that their rules around when judges should be stepping aside from cases mm-hmm. have not kept up with the reality of the importance, both how much money is going into these races and particularly how important these outside groups have become. Now, Wisconsin is an extreme case in that they actually passed a rule saying that the mere spending on by an outside group in a judicial election on its own could not be a basis to step aside from a case, which I think is remarkable and completely at odds with both what the Supreme Court has said about, you know, outside spending and, mm-hmm. and when it can create an appearance of bias or a reality of bias.
It's mind-blowing,
well,
in truth. What happened in Wisconsin...
The public thinks as well.
Yeah. What happened in Wisconsin, what is continuing to happen in Wisconsin, continues to blow me away. We've talked about it a lot on this show. It's just remarkable. And you're right. It is sort of in contrast with the U.S. Supreme Court itself. Is this trend related to the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision in 2012 opening up the use of this kind of dark money, undisclosed money, or is it a trend that's been around longer than that?
Well, you know, we've seen money in these races for many years, but the growing role of outside groups does correspond with Citizens United and how that's kind of opened up this whole new way of spending in these races. So, you know, Citizens United was in 2010, starting in the next election cycle, 2011 to 2012, we saw a real uptick in spending by outside groups, and that's only gone up higher. And as you said, this year we've already broken the record, and there's still, you know, more than a week to go before Election Day, which is pretty remarkable. Mm. So, you know, certainly it's corresponded in that way. And, you know, I think why some of it is, you know, there's now, you know, super PACs, other groups that didn't used to be allowed to spend in this way are now able to. And it's also led to this growing prominence of these dark money groups that don't need to disclose their donors that are now seeking to weigh in. I also think there's been just a cultural shift. You know, some of these states didn't have particularly strong campaign finance laws to begin with, mm-hmm. but I think post-Citizens United, it's really normalized spending by outside groups and has you know, I think we've been seeing that on the federal side as well as in state races, that, you know, it's also just shifted the culture around that, and I think people and groups feel more comfortable just weighing in this way, which is, you know, is a really troubling development. You know, I think especially in judicial races because of the conflicts of interest it can create.
Second to last question in that case, what, if anything, is the solution to what is a seemingly a growing problem and only going to get worse? Is there a solution?
I think states need to take a close look at their selection systems writ large. You know, I think that, I mean, we were talking a little earlier about these reselection pressures, you know, among other things, I think it's, you know, the fact that so many judges are having to go, you know, up for re-election and have their decisions scrutinized and, you know, subject to misleading attack ads and the like is a really troubling development and something that, you know, I think really warrants states looking more closely at how they're structuring their selection systems to begin with. You know, I mean, we also need measures like stronger recusal rules, so judges are not hearing cases involving major campaign spenders, measures like public financing so that, you know, at the very least, the judges themselves don't need to fundraise from the very interests that are appearing before them. You know, if you've got a good public financing system, then at least a judge can run a competitive race without needing to do that kind of fundraising from interests, many of which are regularly participating in court.
I think public funding of elections is the solution to a lot of the problems we're facing in this country right now, to be frank. All right, last question. Totally separate issue here, Alicia, but I know you clerked for Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor when she was an appellate judge on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. I think she's so far proved to be a fantastic justice, and I will feel much better knowing that she is there after Ruth Bader Ginsburg eventually leaves the court, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg ever actually leaves the court. Can you offer a thought as a clerk for Sotomayor, based on your experiences with her, what should folks know about her that maybe we do not know already?
I mean, she's a remarkable person. She is, you know, one of the smartest people I've ever met, but she's also just a really kind person. You know, we would sit around in chambers and she would, you know, she'd know everything about, you know, your life and your family and, you know, your latest diet. And, you know, we were just, you know, she was such a warm person and such a caring mentor. So I think the country is really lucky to have her on the bench. And like I said, she's one of the most brilliant people I've ever met. And I've loved reading her opinions now that she's on the Supreme Court, and, you know, seeing her voice in the mix, I think is just an incredible thing for the country.
Thank you for that reassuring opinion. I'll take such assurance these days anywhere I can find it. Alicia Bannon, she's the senior counsel in the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Check out their remarkable analysis. We didn't even get into some of the specifics of how this affects some of these cases down in Louisiana, where there's all of these cases, you know, against the oil companies, and, you know, the oil companies, in fact, are putting in all of this money into a Supreme Court justice race down there. It's amazing. The report is outside groups set TV spending record in judicial races as Obama endorses a North Carolina judge. You can find that at BrennanCenter.org. You can find them on the Twitters at Brennan Center. And you can find Alicia Bannon on the Twitters as well at Alicia_Bannon. Thanks so much for your work here and for joining us today, Alicia.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Okay, a quick break, and we're back with more broadcast in our remaining minutes here. How the hell did the Bundy brothers get off the hook up in Oregon? We'll talk about that right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. I think they were hoping for a revolution up in Oregon, those Bundy brothers, but they didn't get one. But they did get off scot-free, apparently, at least for now. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. The kind of amazing, this month-long trial against Amon and, is that how you say it? Amon Bundy?
I think it's Amon.
Amon and Ryan Bundy and five of their followers. They were charged in the armed takeover of a federally owned Oregon wildlife sanctuary back in January of this year. Wow, it seems longer ago. They were acquitted on Thursday of federal conspiracy and weapon charges, which is kind of amazing. This is after a month-long trial. The defendants never denied they had occupied and held the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge headquarters for nearly 6 weeks. They took over this thing, demanding that the federal government surrender 188,000 acres of property to local control. But their lawyers argued that the prosecutors did not prove that the group had engaged in an illegal conspiracy that kept federal workers employees of the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bureau of Land Management from doing their jobs. And somehow the jury bought that, believed that. And these guys are off the hook. They took over this federal property with
guns,
automatic weapons, and held it for 6 weeks, and now they're off the hook?
Yeah,
really?
It's pretty wild. Governor Kate Brown, she put a statement on Twitter saying she was disappointed in the verdict. A lot of people are just gobsmacked by this. It was apparently an all-white jury, but, you know, Oregon is primarily white. Mm-hmm. The jurors were taken from all over the state. And there is a question. One observer I read said that, you know, a conspiracy charge is hard to prove a lot of times. So that might be something to do with that. And others had brought up the idea of jury nullification. You gave a great explanation of what that is.
Well, the idea that when a jury feels for whatever reason that the law is unfair or unjust, and despite the facts of the case, they decide to find against that for whatever reasons they may have. But I'll tell you, I had a group of armed Muslims or even African Americans overtaken a federal facility and held it for 6 weeks, I don't think they would have gotten out of it alive.
Yes.
And much less been found not guilty in a trial.
And a lot of folks were also making comparisons to, on the same day, you know, the armed conflict that took place in North Dakota over Standing Rock. You know, Rolling Stone writer Jesse Burney tweeted, you know, in case you're wondering what white privilege looks like, it's taking over a federal building with guns and getting off scot-free, a jarring contrast to the intimidation of Native people at Standing Rock who are unarmed and demonstrating for a legitimate cause.
And not only that, they're on private land. I mean, there's nothing going on there as far, they're on public land where they are, and they've already been roughed up there as well. But, you know, they haven't taken over a federal facility with guns. But they're Native American. So call out the pepper spray and the LRADs and the MRAPs and the state of emergency. These guys, now one of them was shot, during the standoff while he was trying to run from officials.
Well, and also it looked like he was drawing his firearm. So.
Exactly. But the fact that these guys got off the hook, I cannot imagine that happening to anyone who was non-white. Anyway, these guys also, by the way, they're not completely off the hook. They still stand to face charges, I think, in Nevada for their response to the federal officials.
Back in 2014, the standoff at the Bundy Ranch.
With their father, also a scofflaw. Their father, the scofflaw rancher, Cliven Bundy, and his refusal to pay up millions of dollars that he owes in federal grazing privileges. So good. They'll face charges on that. Hope they get them this time. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thank you very much, Des. To my guest today, Alicia Bannon of NYU Brennan Center's Democracy Program, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is greatly appreciated, as is the support of those of you who have stopped by bradblog.com/donate. To help us continue to do what we try to do 5 days a week over your public airwaves. We could not do it without your help. So thank you very much for that. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it for free at bradblog.com. Leave a comment. Say hello there if you like. Do the same if you prefer over at iTunes or any other podcast site where the broadcast is held. And we'd love to hear from you as well on the Facebooks and the Twitters. Get the word out. Help share the broadcast with everyone you know. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, we are simply The Brad Blog. If you prefer, you can drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. That's it. Angie Coiro will be in for us on the next thrilling broadcast. We'll be back thereafter. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.